WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Prosecutors initially said that Martinez was a high-ranking gang member. Since then, they've walked that back.
We are at a crossroads. And at every crossroads in history, progress has come because ordinary people chose courage over comfort.
Democratic primary is closely contested, but what about on the Republican side?
In Illinois, we're going to flip the script. The problems are with one-party Democratic rule.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. The fast-moving murder-for-hire trial involving Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino comes to an end. Mayor Brandon Johnson drops out of a competition to buy back city parking meters. Plus, we learn more about the Bears fan known as the Cheese Grater Guy.
The proposal would give Police Superintendent Larry Snelling the power to impose a curfew anywhere in the city with 12 hours notice.
I know the police can use it effectively. And the reason we know that is because on New Year's Eve, that's exactly what they did.
The rules on selling hemp and hemp-derived THC products in Chicago are about to get a lot tougher.
It's legal if you drink it with a straw. And it's illegal if you chew it with your mouth.
We don't want to have an underground market that punishes small businesses who have been operating within the law.
We're going to start today's episode with what's been happening in the city council. But first, Chicago Sun-Times investigative reporter Bob Hergeth, who's one of our panelists this week, he joins me now to share what he's learned about a local group that some are describing as a doomsday cult. Hey, Bob, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
This is an interesting one. Why don't you tell us about the World Mission Society Church of God?
Sure. It's a religious organization. They describe themselves as Christian. They were founded in Korea, South Korea. And among the beliefs are that a man who died in the mid-80s is basically the Messiah, second coming of Christ. Mm-hmm. And a woman who's still alive, older woman in South Korea, is also sort of the feminine divine. And so that's so a living God. And, you know, they have a lot of critics and that describe it as, you know, quote unquote cult. Mm.
And is that a fair term?
It's a radioactive word. You know, it used to be thrown around quite a bit. But, you know, what experts say is there are good cults and bad cults. And, you know, this is America, obviously, and you can believe what you want. It's all legal and it's fine. So it's not so much about the beliefs. It's about the effectuation of those beliefs and how they are sort of implemented. And are they harmful to people, either, you know, physically, emotionally, spiritually, or otherwise? Mm-hmm. And what critics say is that this group is emotionally and spiritually destructive and would be categorized and defined as a cult.
Well, while officials with the organizations, they've been secretive about the size of their membership, but it is clear that their real estate footprint here in Chicago is expanding. I mean, they've purchased churches from mainstream congregations, haven't they?
Sure, yes. You know, they do say on their website they've got, I think, 4 million people worldwide, but in the U.S. and in Chicago, they would not say how many members they have. But what's, you know, undeniable is that they have been, their footprint has been growing. I mean, they didn't really even have a footprint in the U.S. until maybe the late 90s and in Chicago until the early aughts, and where they started, I think, in what's called a house church. And now they have 5 sites, one downtown, you know, south suburbs, Oak Lawn, west suburbs, Bloomingdale, north suburbs, Niles, and far west suburbs, Naperville. And several of those properties were, yes, as you said, purchased from mainline denominations. A couple of evangelical churches sold to them.
This is truly fascinating stuff. I'm glad you could stop by to fill us in on this one, Bob, but there is so much more news to get to, so why don't we dive in? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Mac Lederman, Block Club Chicago reporter, and Taman Bradley, a WGN political editor and host of the forthcoming nightly show called The Point. The Chicago City Council is banning the sale of most intoxicating hemp products. So, Mac, what exactly is included in this ban?
So everyone has been seeing these stores. Pretty much it feels like they popped up overnight everywhere in the city of Chicago. Some are actually directly across the street from actual state-licensed dispensaries. They're selling these products where they have hemp flower, hemp vapes, hemp edibles. Those are all gone now, Sasha. Mm. So these head shops, these bakeries that are selling these THC-infused items won't be able to operate come April 1st if the ban stands. They'll face thousands of dollars in city fines and potentially city inspectors seizing their products if they keep this stuff out on the shelves. But there is one significant carve-out to this ban, Sasha, and that's THC drinks. And that's because the city's very powerful hospitality lobby and restaurant industry worked with aldermen to keep these drinks in there because they're selling these at bars, they're selling these at craft breweries, they're selling these at concert venues. So kind of a workaround to the state dispensary licensing rules. And these drinks are very popular, especially as alcohol sales dip amongst people in my generation.
Interesting. Mayor Johnson opposed the original version of this measure. So how is this one different? So we're clear?
Well, this one, Mayor Johnson continues to oppose any form of banning intoxicating hemp. He's actually pushed to regulate and tax hemp to raise city revenue. The argument against the ban is that these hemp products, they support small businesses. A lot of businesses that they say were kind of locked out or priced out operating state-run dispensaries. These licenses can be very expensive. They require a certain amount of square footage, a sort of amount of money to be able to open these types of places. And it's kept marijuana kind of out of corner stores like we see with alcohol, which is pretty much, you buy it pretty much anywhere at this point.
Yeah.
So the mayor, he wants to keep hemp around, and he's been floating out the V word, veto. He could potentially veto the ban here and keep these stores in business, but that would be certainly a very significant measure.
Yeah. What do you think, Taman? Will the mayor veto this ban?
Well, the mayor didn't want to say, didn't want to show his hand. He may just have to just let it go, right? Because we know that the state has been looking at this and hasn't known what to do. You have a federal ban that is set to take place. I think he, do a little prediction here. I think this, he may just let this go, knowing that you need to wait to pick a different fight with the council.
Yeah. Well, speaking with fight here, he's also made headlines this week. Johnson grappled with the city's much-hated privatized parking meter deal, Taman. What is the very latest? What should we know?
Well, we should know that the city explored possibly buying back the parking meters, getting them back. It is an infamous deal signed in 2008, 75 years of someone else controlling the city parking meters. So then when you come downtown to hang out at Navy Pier to come see you, Sasha, anytime you feed that meter, that money goes to the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi and other groups. The city of Chicago doesn't get any of that revenue. Again, a 75-year deal. In fact, the $2 billion paid for it has already been made back. That group of investors, initially put down, and so tremendous amount of annual lost revenue for the city. And so the mayor explored maybe getting it back because it turns out it was up for sale.
Right.
But the mayor ultimately did not want to make a bad deal even worse because it would cost double, triple what the city initially paid to get it back. And then, of course, parking habits are changing. People aren't using vehicles as much because of how much the city has had to raise the rates. You don't want to park downtown. You're maybe taking an Uber or public transportation.
Or you're not going downtown at all.
Correct. And so the saga continues. If it would have been a way to maybe close us always referring to it, anytime you talk about something that's just bad, a bad financial deal or a bad government decision, we point to the parking meters. It'll live on now.
Bob, as the city struggles with a more than $1 billion budget shortfall, we are being told that more than $26 million was incorrectly paid out in overtime. What are the details?
Yeah. Inspector General came out with a report identifying this, and it does stem back a few years before Mayor Johnson was mayor, to Lori Lightfoot's tenure, and it is a lot of money, and it's kind of
$26 million. Yeah,
it's
a lot.
It's pretty goofy, and just speaks to what seems to be ever present, which is mismanagement and sloppiness and or corruption. Although, you know, that's $26 million, while a lot, I mean, I would point to, and that money could be used in, you know, a variety of ways, you know, in theory, but, you know, a story that we did that didn't get as much kind of blip as this one is two of my colleagues did about all the uncollected debt with the city that measures in the billions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yes, they should, every dime should be accounted for. That's taxpayer money, et cetera. But there are other even bigger issues out there in play, kind of swilling about that could really enhance revenues without increasing taxes, for that matter.
Yeah, the Inspector General, Deborah Witzberg, she told the Tribune that the payouts, the $26 million in payouts, they weren't nefarious or stealing, but they were akin to a series of spreadsheet errors. Mm-hmm. Someone needs to learn how to use Excel, it seems like. We've also got an update on a teen curfew measure that we've been talking about for so long. It was supposed to go to a vote, Taman, but it stalled in the city council. What is the latest?
Yeah, so...
can these teens hang out outside?
Well...
Or not?
Ask Brian Hopkins, right? He's the alderman that has been pushing really hard for this. He wanted the police superintendent to have the power to be able to, with 12 hours notice, declare a curfew downtown to get ahead of the teen trends or the takeovers. And ultimately, there was a compromise. He says he talked with the fifth floor and that what he wanted to do is... If in fact you have a group and they're trying to cause trouble, they're trying to incite something, that in fact you could order a dispersal order, that may or may not already be on the books. I think what Hopkins wanted to do is to codify that. Mayor Johnson, it's about as open as we've heard him to sort of modifying what we do now with curfews, because we have an existing curfew in place.
Right.
And so, but... Alders at council didn't want to vote on some language that they just got moments before council, to their credit, because we've seen where things pop up and they decide to do it and then argue over the rules. So sort of like the parking meters, this saga goes on because Brian Hopkins is not letting up.
To be continued. Keeping you in the hot seat here, Taman, the city council approved another police misconduct settlement. What should we know about this one?
Another one, $22 million to a man in his 20s who was driving his Honda, I think it was, when police were pursuing a stolen vehicle, and he died and when that vehicle that they were pursuing collided with his. It just raises questions, of course, about police pursuit policy. That mm-hmm. was in the spotlight 2 years ago, 3 years ago when this happened. They're not supposed to pursue. In these instances, it raises questions about technology. Mm-hmm. We should have license plate readers, helicopters, other ways to track stolen vehicles, because these pursuits are dangerous. And then you can have an innocent victim that dies, as happened here. And then, of course, these massive police misconduct settlements that
yes.
continue.
The payouts are always
to pay out as the city
large.
Tries to budget for it, but it's been hard to do.
As the city awaits the revenue that's expected from that riverfront casino, we're now hearing that the project may be delayed a year, Bob.
Yep. So this is, I mean...
Next question.
Yep, you're correct. No, but I mean, where to begin with this casino? I mean, from the start, there was controversy. There were questions about first of all, why Bally's was chosen. And then secondly, can it really muster up the money and the, you know... To complete this, and the questions are still there, even though as I drove in this morning, drove past the site where they're building the permanent casino, right? The temporary casinos at the Medina Temple, River North, they're building the new permanent one in River West, and it's, you know, the construction is pretty far along, but will it be finished? You know, that's the question. Mm-hmm. So they were supposed to be done, you know, basically within the next year or so, and now they've got presumably an extension here is the push. And that they need the time and to get it done. So, I mean, it's not just that this is going to be presumably, you know, longer to build this and then longer for the revenues to come into the city and the company. But, you know, is this emblematic of larger problems? And I think that question's still, you know, to be determined.
Yeah, I mean, that Medina Temple, Mac, I mean, that casino, I feel like it's not giving what it was supposed to give, right? The returns have fallen far short of what was expected. So I wonder if you think that there will be concerns growing about the permanent casino. Is that one in jeopardy, you think? Are folks thinking that way?
No doubt, Shasha, Medina has been a flop, but we've been doing reporting on how people are being bused from neighborhoods, from Chinatown, just to be taken to this casino to actually get people in the seats there, and it's not working. The revenue projections are way under. But as far as the permanent casino on the Riverwalk, I don't want to eat my words later, but I do think it's definitely going to happen. The city needs the money to pay the pensions, point blank, period, and this is a period of very intense speculation around that stretch of riverfront, mm-hmm. in particular with the Chicago Fire Stadium coming in there. I believe there's also a proposal for a Universal Studios kind of immersive experience thing. So a lot of investors, a lot of city officials see tremendous potential around that section of riverfront, of developing the riverfront farther from what we have right now. So I think just the potential money signs at the end of the road here are too grand not to take the swing. Mm.
Speaking of the Medina, how many people here have actually been, right?
It's not once.
Alders, me either. Alders are raising questions about the advertising. Do people know, or are you still going over to Hammond? And so we got to get the word out that, you know, there's gaming now in Chicago
exists.
And there's casinos.
And right.
You know. Yeah, I just don't know if I see Chicago as a destination for gambling unless the crowds who come around St. Patrick's Day are running into the casino.
Well, that, and then you could pick up people after a ball game and stuff like that. I mean, it's just something to do in our great city. Of course, everything else, museums and everything else are there. But yeah, we got to get the word out if, in fact, you're going to generate revenue.
Well, Bally's also opposed something that was included in the alternate budget that was passed in December by City Council. That's legalized video gambling in Chicago, Bob. Where are we with that now, and how might that impact this riverfront casino that we're talking about?
Yeah, this is a very interesting time gambling-wise, right? Because, I mean, 10 years ago plus, I mean, there were fixed casinos mostly on the rivers, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. And now you've got video gambling in the suburbs almost everywhere. The city of Chicago has not had legal video gambling, but now there's a proposal to do that. And if and when that comes, I think it's still a little bit to be seen, but there is that fearful, first of all, this proliferation and the impact on communities and, you know, on gambling addictions and stuff like that. It's not just all about revenue. There also are, you know, societal, social ills associated with expanded gambling that has just exploded across the Chicago region. Mm-hmm. But then also there is a financial impact. First of all, I mean, studies have shown that a lot of people that gamble are the ones who can least afford to do so. So that's, you know, that's one thing. But then on the other financial front, from a public sector perspective, the implementation of video gambling within the city proper cannibalize the revenues that otherwise would go to the casino, which mm-hmm. whose, you know, revenues then, you know, trickle down to the city. At least they're counting on it, right, to shore up pension funds, et cetera. So that's part of the dilemma.
And you just did an investigation, right, into sort of the crime associated with this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing with video gambling in the suburbs and downstate. It is absolutely epidemic in terms of the crime. It has been soaring in terms of burglaries. We have seen some robberies too, but mostly burglaries. The numbers are way, way up all across the suburbs, the south suburbs, the west suburbs, the northern suburbs. And the mayor actually commented for my story through his spokesperson that, you know, there are public safety concerns with legalizing this within the city, which of course there would be. I mean, the old saying, Willie Sutton, the old bank robber from the Prohibition era, you know, his old saying was, you know, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is.
Yeah.
Well, you know where the money is now? In these video gambling cafes.
Mm-hmm.
And the casinos themselves have seen a lot of crime, which I have also done a story on. So, you know, this is a complicated issue.
mail-in ballots for the March primary go out in 2 weeks. Early voting in some suburbs begins February 5th and a week later here in Chicago. So let's walk through where we are with a few of the races. How about we start with the race to replace retiring Senator Dick Durbin? Do we have a clear front runner, Taman?
Absolutely there is. It is Raja Krishnamoorthy, who began the contest with $19 million in the bank, went up on television last fall, has been really consistent. He is going up against Congresswoman Robin Kelly, who's quite popular, has a little bit of money, but maybe the messaging has been hard for her to get that focus and to draw attention. And then Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton,
yes,
backed by Governor Pritzker and Senator Tammy Duckworth. Everyone expects Governor Pritzker to write a massive check,
yes,
to her.
Are you surprised she's not in the lead with that big endorsement?
Well, you would think, but she does. You know, she's been elected twice to statewide office as the lieutenant governor, but she has certainly struggled to separate herself from Governor Pritzker, and then she's never had to raise large sums of money by herself. So she was getting up to speed with her finance operation. She's new to some community groups, and she's gone and talked to people on behalf of Pritzker. The relationship is not there. Remember when the governor tapped her to be his lieutenant governor running mate, that she had only been in the state legislature for half a year. And so that existing relationship is not there. But you see a super PAC now that's probably very well funded, that is airing commercials. They've got a positive ad for Stratton. And there's still a lot of our polling. Emerson College, WGN TV did a poll. And so Raja Krishnamoorthy had a massive advantage. However, there were still a lot of undecided voters, almost half of people said they were undecided. And so I think Stratton and Kelly's theory of the case is to capture those people. They're arguing that Krishnamoorthy has perhaps reached his ceiling, but we'll see.
Anyone else at the table have thoughts on why Stratton and her campaign might be struggling here? Yeah.
Well, no, I just, it's, it is.
Well, let's talk, I think, about, that says it all.
Let's talk about Congresswoman Robin Kelly then.
Money matters,
money,
right?
Money.
Is what it comes down to. And so, you know, there are other people who certainly had their eye on this seat, but when you see that you have a candidate that has almost $20 million in the bank, that's intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see, but Stratton, might this race tighten? It's certainly the stakes are high. You know, Governor Pritzker would very much like an ally in the U.S. Senate to be able to, because I think he'll have to explain, why didn't she do better if this is the candidate that you back, if you've in fact spent $300 million
of
your own.
Is she really recognizable for most people, you think?
I think that's been the problem.
Yeah.
I do. People.
So it's money and it's that.
Yeah. I mean, people want to know that they've known you, that you've done the work,
yeah,
that you've been there for them. Maybe she has. I mean, but the polling certainly suggests that's
right.
She's not connecting.
How's Congresswoman Robin Kelly doing?
So a little bit of a struggle there, but she's certainly very well liked. And so I would actually, I expect her numbers to move because she has deep ties, a very diverse district representing Chicago, and then heading south almost to exurb type territory outside of the Chicagoland area. But she has a little bit of money in the bank, and you know, she's from making a name for herself a little bit and drawing headlines by talking about impeaching Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary.
That's right.
And so as Stratton tries to draw attention for a kid, but there's a series of debates. You guys have a debate,
yes,
coming up on Monday.
Exactly. Yeah. For anyone who wants more information on these three candidates, they will be participating in a debate on Monday night. It's happening inside of the University of Chicago's International House, and we're going to be broadcasting it live here at 6 p.m. on Monday on 91.5 WBEZ. We'll also stream live on both the BEZ and SunTimes YouTube channels.
And I don't want to get in trouble here because it hasn't been announced, but I would expect another one in February. Just stay tuned. Ooh.
So we've made it through the leading Democrats running for Durbin's Senate seat. There are also Republicans on the March primary ballot. These candidates aren't well known, but I mean, anyone clearly in the lead there, Taman?
So in the race for governor, it's Darren Bailey. So it looks like we're headed for a repeat of 2022. When Bailey took on Governor Pritzker in the general, but Rick,
yes,
Heidner, who is he's got a little bit of money. He is someone who really only got his campaign going a short time ago, And he, you know, he's known as the video gambling mogul who, you know, tried to get a casino going in Tinley Park, and that application was denied. Ted Dabrowski has got some money. He's an issue person known from Wire Points. Mm-hmm. But it does look like it's Darren Bailey's race to lose, just because he connects with the grassroots. He's right. From downstate Illinois. He's a farmer.
Yeah. Of course, Bob, Illinois is a solidly blue state. I mean, does it seem unlikely to you that any Republican could win the Senate seat?
I think it's probably unlikely. But, I mean, there have been statewide, I mean, plenty of, you know, statewide Republicans elected. I mean, look right. at, like, most of the governors over the past X number of years. I mean, Bruce Rauner, George Ryan, Jim Edgar, Jim Thompson, right, dating all the way back. I mean, the Republicans really held a lock on that seat for a while, and that's statewide. So, I mean, it's possible. Even in Cook County, we've had Republicans. I mean, Jack O'Malley was a state's attorney for, you know, some years. So, I mean, things do happen. Republicans can bubble up. But, I mean, but then again, I mean, the elections are often where the money is, and there's a lot of money in the Democratic race.
Yeah. Any other big races on your radar, Mac?
Yeah, 9th Congressional District. My colleague McNumke just hosted a forum with a lot of the candidates, and there are many candidates in that race, but a few very notable ones, especially Kat Abu-Ghazaleh, who has collected lots and lots and lots of money and many millions of likes on her content on social media related to politics. So
yes,
kind of in this era where we have the television, nightly news, Fox News, CNN, the pundits going from your TV screen to your phone, seeing if that actually translates into votes enough to carry someone who hasn't lived in the district they're running for very long into a political office. So how well she does, if she's even close to winning this race, I think is a topic of national note. And also on immigration, I think this race is an interesting test to see how far candidates can take immigration issues to the ballot box. Obviously, Kat Abu-Ghazaleh is one of the people who is being federally indicted for actions related to the Broadview ICE facility outside. Daniel Bliss has had his fair share of encounters with Border Patrol agents and Gregory Bovino. So if that translates into people going out there and voting for these candidates, we'll see.
She's gained a lot of attention in that contest. So we had a joke, I guess it's somewhat funny, maybe it's not funny, that the sun hasn't even come up, and Abu-Ghazaleh had an incident with ICE. She'd been thrown to the ground or whatever it might be. Yeah, all of the candidates went up there. You know, it's good politics to sort of, even get yourself in handcuffs, right? That's just the shrewd nature of politics. But I would watch Daniel Biss, the mayor of Evanston, in that contest. He's got money. He's got ties to the community. Mm-hmm. She certainly, you know, she does these CNN hits and things like that. But he's got name ID. And so, you know, and he's just more experienced. She's never held elected office. I'd watch him.
Joining us now is John Seidel. He's the federal courts reporter for the Sun-Times. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
So I've got you in here because the aggressive ICE enforcement, as we've seen, it continues in Minneapolis and it's moved on to places like Maine. But here in Chicago, a jury really quickly came back with a not guilty verdict in that murder-for-hire case of Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino. So tell us, you know, testimony kind of moved quickly there, and the jury deliberations did as well. I mean, was that expected?
I mean, last week when Judge Lefko handed down a ruling that kind of barred a lot of evidence from this case, we had a sense that this was going to be swift. There were three witnesses. They spent about 3 hours combined on the witness stand, and then the jury deliberated for 3 hours. And I should say those were three prosecution witnesses. The defense also put somebody up. But, of course, this is the case that began with claims that a ranking member of the Latin Kings had put a hit out on Bovino. And this was touted far and wide. It's been cited before the Supreme Court, and it's kind of underscored these claims that drug cartels and street gangs have been putting hits on people like Bovino and other federal officials. But then earlier this month, prosecutors acknowledged to the judge that they weren't going to even try to prove that Juan Espinoza Martinez, the defendant, had a gang affiliation. Mm-hmm. And that led Judge Lefko to bar a lot of the evidence. Prosecutors told her that pretty much all the evidence in this case is tied somehow to the Latin Kings. She still wouldn't let it in, and the government moved forward anyway.
Yeah, the federal prosecutors really slapped all kinds of labels on defendant Martinez, but the jury just didn't buy it, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they didn't. They came back very quickly with this not guilty verdict. They did so. I mean, the prosecutors did come in. They argued that these were the defendant's words. He sent this Snapchat message to somebody he knew in the construction business. It said something like, 2K for info on Bovino, 10K if you take him down or something. And it suggested the Latin Kings were on him. And they said these were the defendant's words. And, you know, they pointed to other things like, well, he tracked down a picture of Bovino to send with the message. And they said he was angry and fixated on Bovino. But the defense was really kind of twofold, where on the one hand, they said that he was just, you know, things were moving fast and furious in Little Village in October, and people in the community were just trying to share information about what was going on as best they could. But then they also just argued that the government hadn't proved its case, and they told the jury that they should really demand more evidence before convicting somebody of murder for hire.
And so we're clear, John, 31 defendants have been charged in Chicago with non-immigration crimes tied to Operation Midway Blitz, but not a single person has been convicted, right?
Right. Not so far. We've seen 15 people cleared. I mean, that leaves roughly, 16 people. There's still several cases pending. But at best, unless, you know, the pool grows, we're looking at a conviction rate of roughly 50%, which is really low for federal prosecutors.
All right. That's John Seidel from the Chicago Sun-Times. Thank you so much for checking in.
You bet. Take care, guys.
All right, Mac, I want to turn to something that you spent a lot of time working on in the fall and, you know, the aggressive middle of the night, if you will, ICE raid. This was of the apartment building in South Shore. The state is now investigating whether the owner tipped off federal authorities.
Yeah, this is something that's been in the air for a while. Reporters, people in that building have been reading the tea leaves. There was a floor plan found after the raid of which units appeared to be targeted. Also, residents saying that the lease-paying tenants, the U.S. Citizen tenants, had their doors not knocked in compared to other residents. So a lot of potential signs here to point towards collaboration with the landlord, who was in deep underwater with this building and others she owned in South Shore. And many of these residents inside these buildings were Venezuelan migrants on temporary state housing assistance, people on Section 8 and CHA vouchers. And problems with crime and security and just deteriorating conditions. It's just the landlord couldn't quite get a grip on the building. So signs point to a potential collaboration. Now the state is investigating just that. Governor J.B. Pritzker says this is a human rights discrimination case by his human rights department. So not really sure what the mechanism is to come down on these landlords and the property manager. But many of the residents are excited to see at least some attempt at accountability. So we'll see what comes of it.
Yeah, I mean, the reporters may have been reading the tea leaves on this one, but my jaw certainly dropped when I just heard this. I mean, Bob and Timon, you remember this viral raid, right? The ICE agents landing on the roof from a helicopter, like, you know, making a Hollywood movie, essentially.
Rappelling onto the roof. What was it? 300 agents, 37 people arrested. No charges, right, Mac? No one was ever...
No charges.
My good.
And no connection to Venezuelan gang members, like the federal government had said there were when they released their kind of report on why they did this. There's been little evidence to show that.
Stunning show of force. And it's symbolic of this operation, what some would say is overreach. It's one of the iconic moments of what we saw from the fall, that and the raid on the Rayito de Sol, agents pursuing a teacher into the daycare.
Oh, the daycare. Yes, absolutely.
I was going to say that Chicago is a great theater town, right? And this is theater. I mean, to a lot of people, right? That's,
it is.
You know, really you need to rappel down a helicopter, you know, and... Anyway, but that's
at least theater to these federal authorities, that's for sure. And Bob, you know, Chicago Cardinal Blaise Cupich, you know, he's been outspoken in his opposition to President Trump's immigration tactics. But this week, he also weighed in on the president's foreign policy. What did he have to say about that?
Yeah, Cardinal Cupich is the quote unquote spiritual leader of Catholics in the Chicago region, Cook and Lake counties, and he reports up to the Pope. And he and two other ecclesiastical leaders in the U.S., one of whom he's very close with, Cardinal McElroy, wrote a letter, you know, statement basically decrying the militarization of the world here under Trump, you know, with threats of taking over Greenland and just war in general and violence becoming normalized in terms of, you know, by by leaders. He did not name Trump directly. Obviously, that was who he was referring to. So, yeah, I got some press, but it's, you know, there are just like the world and just like our country being very polarized and split, so is the Catholic Church and so is the Catholic Church leadership. I mean, you saw three cardinals signing on to this, but there are a number of Catholic bishops who would never sign anything with Cardinal Cupich. He's not well-liked by many. He's kind of represents more of the left, progressive aspect of the Catholic Church, and there are a lot on the right who support Trump or at least some of his policies in particular because of abortion rights and, you know, that kind of topic.
While the Bears' magical NFL season came to an end on Sunday, womp womp, this was in that heart-stopping overtime against the LA Rams. You wrote a profile, Mac, that I thought was super cool. This was about the local the local gentleman who attended the game. He, you know, he caught everybody's eye. His name is Brandon Martinez, better known, though, I think, as the cheese grater man.
Absolutely, Sasha. First, I want to say you labeled the show section miscellaneous, and it's like all Block Club stories, so thank you for that. I think
yes.
Miscellaneous is where Block Club
You guys
shines.
Rule in the miscellaneous category. You're on the ground. You're finding the things. How did you track this guy down?
So, I'll keep my sources close to my chest as a good journalist does, but I was the first person to find him. And I put out a call on Twitter and suddenly I got a message on my phone be like, everyone tells me you're looking for me. And it's exactly the guy I was looking for. His name is Brandon Martinez. He's 38 years old. He works at a chemical plant blending antifreeze on a day job. He's got two young kids and he absolutely loves the Bears. He's the life of the party. So he showed up at the Bears-Packers game with chunks of cheese from his wheel at home that he helps this kid to put on his Parmesan. He brought a cheese grater at Jewel Osco.
And he got it through security.
Yes, he did, with some liquid courage from some quote-unquote Miller lattes, as he said. And the rest is history. The moment goes viral, and come the next week for the Bears game against the Rams, Miller Lite actually paid for him to go to the game and get prime seats to watch the Bears' almost miraculous comeback against the Rams to pull it out. Not quite, but I'm just happy for Cheese Grater Guy, man. Someone who just so gracefully dealt with his 15 minutes of fame. He got his kids involved.
Yes.
He got the TV crews to come to his favorite pizzeria because he knows the owner. Just really, really graceful, very professional. Just it couldn't have happened to a better guy.
So Chicago, too, right? Yeah. Bob, did you see all this?
Yeah. And watching the game, too. It's hard to be too upset with the Bears, you know, for losing, because it was just, you know, the games that they lost, most of them certainly were down to the minute. They were, you know, they were close. It was an exciting season. One interesting sort of political side note, I would say, is that they're having a good season for once in a long time, probably helps their position, the team, as they seek out,
stadium.
A new stadium.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's not that that's, you know, I don't personally care about that, but I mean, in terms of the team being good, it was fun to watch, but I'll bet you the McCaskies are happy for that reason too, because it can sturdy up their position, maybe.
Stay in Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, sticking with you here, Bob, because we're going to take the conversation over to Northwest Suburban Elgin and talk about miscellaneous, Mac. Bob's been reporting about a scandal-ridden strip club. Yeah, what's going on? There's lots of drama.
Sure have. It's in the Elgin area, unincorporated, in Kane County. And this strip club is called Blackjack's. It's been around forever, for at least 20, 30 years plus. And the family that owns it, well, there's a father-son that operated it some years back, 15 years ago maybe, and they got indicted and sent to prison for tax fraud and for illegal gambling and pocketing money from the strippers and not reporting it to the IRS and blah, 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 blah. So fast forward today, and now the son's mother and the father's ex-wife, 82 years old, is now the operator of the club, the owner of the club, I'm sorry, and the felonious relatives still own the property. And amidst the criminal case X number of years ago, they lost their liquor license, and so now they've been trying to get it back. And there's just this crazy NIMBY, people don't want it because the alcohol can lead to more problems in theory.
Yeah, local residents are pretty outraged.
Yes, and also just some of the historical legal problems with the previous operator. So it's just been this fascinating sort of story to watch from a government and also sort of morality point of view. And then the Kane County Liquor Commission just recently, after like almost a year of battling and previously rejecting this, did grant them permission to do this. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, back here in the city, Mac, residents of the Northwest Side neighborhood of Saugeenash, they're going to be losing their only bar.
Yeah, they're going to be losing Alarmist Brewing, which is a outpost beloved by many, has an award-winning golden IPA, according to my colleague Molly DeBoer. But they're other sources as well, I'd say. They're one of a string of just craft brewers that have really been cratering ever since the pandemic. A lot of them say that just the barstool traffic isn't there anymore, that people in younger generations aren't drinking as much. I think that's partly why, Sasha, we're seeing these places turn to the hemp drinks, kind of the full circle moment here. But I've written about my fair share of craft breweries around the city that have gone under in the last year or two. Just a really tough time for that business, and we're losing a lot of these kind of third spaces in the city that was really at the initial launching point of the craft brewing movement. This is where it happens, and a lot of these places are now going under.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. It's a trend that we've been noticing here, too. We've also been reporting on the fact that, you know, people just aren't drinking as much anymore. There have been some recent surveys, too, to show some data. But it is time now, folks, for us to discuss the top thing that we haven't talked about yet. Yeah, I'm talking about that Arctic front that brought this dangerously cold temperature overnight and wind chills as low. I think we did go down to at least negative 30. It's supposed to go to negative 35. How was your commute in? First of all, thank you for being here, because I was a little doubtful that you would, all three of you would show up to do this.
You're very welcome. It was a haul. It reminds me that we had a day in 2019 that was worse than this. We had, I believe it was late January.
So this was a piece of cake for you tomorrow?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but imagine minus 18 with minus 40 wind chills. It's a day I'll never forget. The roads were empty. But I'm doing a story about everything going on in the city, some of the politics, and the former head of the teachers union, Chicago Teachers Union, Jesse Sharkey, wanted to stand outside in front of a building to poke Rahm Emanuel about pipes and stuff. And I'm just thinking, we need to get inside ASAP.
Ooh, this I don't miss that though. About my TV days. Early in my career,
stand outside to demonstrate that it's cold.
Oh, yes. And as you can see behind me, and your face is frozen as you say those words. How were things for you this morning, Bob?
Well, I looked at my car thermometer, -7, it said, and then listening to you guys, learned that it was 30 below, but and it felt it. Although,
well, thank you for tuning in.
Yes. I knew I was sort of funny. I knew I was getting old when I started caring about the weather and talking about the weather and thinking about the weather. My kids just rolled their eyes. They don't really care. But yeah, it is insane.
Yeah, my kids, CPS was canceled today, so but she took a shift at her job.
There you
go. She chose to come out in this. How about you, Mac? Did you have skates on this morning?
Well, shouts out to Block Club, who let me comp an Uber to Navy Pier today.
Yes.
I've never seen Navy Pier so dead before, but special shout out to all the postal workers, the CTA bus drivers, the nannies. All the people who are going to work anyway today to keep the city running,
all
Chicago's
the
toughest
workers.
Nails. Yeah.
Hey, man,
essential
brother.
Workers.
And then my last question is, Sasha, I was just wondering anyone here could give me a ride home.
let me see. I might have to get some gas first.
Jumper cables.
Are you north?
Yeah.
All right, WGN's north. Maybe we could work something out.
Okay, we'll work it out. Well, Zachary Yak, who's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, joined me yesterday on In the Loop to talk about the dangers of being outside when it is this cold. Let's listen.
Wind chills of minus 30 to minus 35, like we're forecasting for the city there, that can cause frostbite in as little as 5 to 10 minutes. It can definitely lead to hypothermia very quickly if you're not properly protected, and, of course, even lead to some frozen pipes, too, for any pipes that are exposed outdoors. Definitely recommend, keeping yourself bundled up if you have to be out, but if obviously the best course is just stay inside, stay warm. But you have to be out, again, covering all exposed skin and surfaces, and of course make sure you're trying to limit that time outdoors to as little as time as possible.
Yeah, like I said, the only people celebrating right now are the kids, right? Because CPS, as I said, is one of dozens of area districts canceled today, but those who did have to go outside and commute to work like we did, they might have noticed as well that Metra is running on its weekend schedule, because apparently extreme cold impacts train tracks. Did you all know that? So, you know, they reduced the number of trains coming out today. And another notable cancellation I wanted to share, the 25th annual Polar Bear Plunge fundraiser that was scheduled for tomorrow at Oak Street Beach. Bad news.
Not a strong plan.
Not
what a cruel
happening.
Twist of irony. The Polar Bear Plunge gets canceled because the weather is too polar.
Yeah, it's this is too cold even for the polar bears. But it's not too cold for the Great Lake Jumper. Do you know that he actually still did his jump this morning?
My goodness. Mm. Is he okay?
Well, according to the video, he was fine. I did see a splash. I was like, I hope it's not all ice.
I've read about him before, so I reached out last night to just wish him good luck. And he was like, you know, it's going to be a short day. Thankfully, I have a really good support team to help me, quote unquote, limit exposure. So he'll be just fine.
Yeah, we're talking about Dan O'Connor, if you're wondering. He was on In the Loop earlier this week, and I warned him. I said, Dan, this Friday, minus 35, are you still going to do this? And he said, yep. So, of course, I go on to X this morning, and he's, like clockwork, posted his video to prove that he did his regular 745 jump, of course, with a front flip.
Streak's a streak.
Oh, man. Streak's a streak. Any of you planning to leave your house this weekend?
I hope not. It's up to the little ones if they're, you know, being rowdy and we need to.
Oh, well, how little are your little ones?
So I just had my youngest just turned one.
Oh, wow.
And my oldest is 2.5.
Oh, boy.
I got my hands full.
So you got little
littles.
Yeah,
the daycare closed. Yeah, that daycare closed. Shout out to the wife who took the L.
Did the polar bear plunge news ruin your plans for the weekend, Mac?
You know, that's something I always want to do. There's a community of people who dive into the lake even when it's like this type of weather all throughout the winter. It's a sort of a spiritual experience to some of those people. So
yes.
I wonder where they're at today.
So it's more than just this Dan O'Connor guy.
Yeah.
No, there are other Chicagoans doing this.
Chicago's a community for everything.
Yes. What about you? Weekend plans, Bob?
Reading. I'm taking a class offline. And,
nice.
So I've got homework.
I've got a birthday dinner to attend tomorrow, and she's lucky I love her. Let's just say that.
I think it's going to the movies.
It's at night.
Oh,
it's
my
night.
Goodness.
Yes, it's at night. I love you. Friend, you know who you are. Real quick before we go, anything on your radar for next week? What are you working on, Bob?
Well, I just did a story recently on a religious group that critics have described as a cult for the Sun-Times. Okay. And I've got some potential follow-ups on other controversial faith groups that are in the Chicago region.
Sounds like a regular day on your beat.
That's right.
Mac?
I'm keeping an eye on what's happening in Minneapolis. There was a general strike today, and there's people who are going to go out and protest anyway in minus 10 degree weather against the federal immigration crackdown, which much smaller city than Chicago, agents on pretty much every single street from what I'm hearing on the ground from out there. So maybe a sign of times to come in Chicago come spring when agents are expected to be back.
And Tamon, you're suiting up 6:45 Monday night.
The debut of The Point, our new public affairs program.
Love
so
it.
Honored to be hosting that. Our first guest is Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson.
Ah.
I know he's been on your program many times. Just to let you know, because you have such a great name of your program, we considered Looped In as a possible name before we settled on The Point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to tune in. My thanks to Tamon Bradley of WGN. Bob Hergeth of the Chicago Sun-Times and Mac Lederman of Block Club Chicago. That's it for the weekly news recap. Stay warm, gentlemen. Have a great weekend.
You too, Sasha.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.